While First Energy was executing its HB6 bribery scheme with convicted former House Speaker Larry Householder, it was funneling lots of secret dark money to other elected officials not implicated in the scheme. Newly released documents tell us who. The Westside Market is under new nonprofit management, and should Cleveland fly a new flag? We'll cover those stories today on the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Mike McIntyre. Glad you're with us. Other top news this week includes a push to limit student cell phone access in Ohio schools, a drop in Cleveland homicide numbers, and more local colleges dealing with financial woes. There's another move to close Ohio's primaries, requiring voters to choose their party well before a primary vote. And it's National Arbor Day. You can celebrate by planting a tree. We'd love your thoughts today via email at soi@ideastream.org. First, the news. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Mike McIntyre. Thank you so much for joining us. Governor Mike DeWine says he had no knowledge that First Energy was funneling secret dark money to his election effort at the same time it was orchestrating the HB6 bribery scheme that sent former House Speaker Larry Householder to prison. Other office holders not implicated in the scandal also got the utility's dark money. The Westside Market is no longer being managed by the City of Cleveland. A nonprofit formed to run the market and lead its renovation took over management this week. Homicide numbers are way down in Cleveland, continuing a downward trend since a record homicide year in 2020 at the height of the pandemic. And Lakeland Community College has joined a growing list of higher education institutions facing major financial woes. Joining me to talk about those stories and a ton more on the roundtable this week, IdeaStream Public Media health reporter Stephen Langell is here. Stephen, good morning.
Well, good morning to you.
Good to have you. And Axios Cleveland reporter Sam Allard. Sam, good to have you here.
Pleasure to be here, Mike, as always.
And in Columbus, Ohio Public Radio and Television Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Hey, Karen.
Hey, great to be here with y'all.
Good to be here, and I know you always like to talk about your Guardians. They won yesterday. Can we not talk about the Cavaliers, though? At this
I know. What happened? Oh, my word.
40 points?
Dog poo-poo. Absolute dog poo-poo.
Fluke.
Oh, it's a family
Hopefully.
Show.
Sam with the insightful analysis. All right. We don't take calls on the roundtable, probably because of that. But you can share your thoughts, ask questions via email, soi@ideastream.org. We're not talking Cavs today. We already did. But if you want to talk about them, too, you feel free. soi@ideastream.org. You can also tweet @soundofideas. All right. Let's get ready to roundtable. Newly released documents show that Akron-based First Energy made secret payments that helped benefit the 2018 campaign of Governor Mike DeWine. The payments made through dark money groups came amid the company's bribery of former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder in the House Bill 6 scheme that put Householder into power and got the massive nuclear bailout bill passed. Neither DeWine nor Lieutenant Governor John Husted nor another recipient of the dark money, Senate President Matt Huffman, have been implicated in the scandal. The records were released as part of a public records request. Karen, the contributions in total through dark money groups are in the millions for the DeWine campaign. The governor, though, says no clue.
Yeah, the latest documents show $2.5 million in dark money that went from First Energy to a 501c3 called State Solutions, which... The way these groups work is that they can back issues, they can show campaigns against certain candidates, but they can't work in coordination with candidates. They can't support candidates. And so there's that separation there. And that's what DeWine is saying. He didn't know what this group was doing. This group was an offshoot of the Republican Governors Association. And we do know one of the installment, about $500,000, I think it was actually $500,000, was marked as for DeWine. So that certainly suggests that there might have been, that maybe something was going on. But in the timing of this, in 2018, you had a pretty close race going on between Mike DeWine and Democratic candidate Richard Cordray, and First Energy was giving to both of them through the Republican Governors Association and the Democratic Governors Association in publicly disclosed money. So they were kind of playing both sides here, depending on who won, but certainly they were, I think, focused on this group that was working to try to get DeWine elected.
Right. That was public money that you could see. So we saw that First Energy was playing both sides of the fence, which is probably a politically smart thing to do. But now we're finding out the dark money, which was the whole nexus of this bribery scheme used in the Larry Householder case, that same form of money was flowing into these other candidates. That, I think, makes a number of people perk their ears up a little bit.
Right. And dark money is not illegal. It's not illegal to accept dark money into your political action committee and it's or into your campaign. And it's not you are not supposed to coordinate with groups that are these 501c3s, 501c4s. So the whole idea, though, that dark money is hard to track, that's what it was intended to be. I mean, the source of the money is not does not have to be disclosed for reasons such as you don't want retribution for the money that you're disclosing or that you're donating to someone or some campaign. And so it does bring up the question of whether dark money should be in political campaigns. Is there a way to curtail dark money or require more disclosure of who is giving money to these groups, where their money is coming from?
Right. The other side of that argument is you could be secretly buying influence, which is exactly what happened in the Householder case.
Yeah. And there's another dark money group that we had heard about called Generation Now that was that has pleaded guilty in the First Energy case. And that's, you know, part of the whole scheme here. But this is going back to the 2018 governor's election, which was before House Bill 6. And DeWine actually signed House Bill 6 in his first 8 months as governor.
We hear that money also flowed into Senate President Matt Huffman's account before he was Senate president, or through him to his campaign, through the dark money groups, as well as to the lieutenant governor. What have they said?
Well, I think, once again, you're hearing the idea that, first of all, dark money is not illegal, and secondly, there was no coordination. I mean, DeWine took a lot of questions about this from reporters earlier in the week and said he was not aware that this money had come through, that he didn't know that they had that First Energy had contributed to these groups because, again, there's not allowed to be this coordination. And he also said that it had nothing to do with his decision to sign House Bill 6. And I remember covering House Bill 6 before we knew about any of this. And DeWine had always been public in saying nuclear power is an important part of Ohio's energy portfolio, that he was going to sign House Bill 6 because he wanted to make sure that the two nuclear plants were not going to be closed, which had been the threat all along that created House Bill 6, was that these two nuclear plants owned by First Energy Solutions, a subsidiary of First Energy, were going to have to close because they needed state funding to keep going.
So I want to make clear before we end this part of the conversation, there has been no accusation of wrongdoing against DeWine, Husted, or Huffman.
Yes.
The questions that are being raised by folks are that at the time of this bribery scheme, that's when this dark money was flowing. And so could there be some sort of relationship? People are positing that. There has been no accusation.
Right. And Husted and DeWine have both been asked for information, have been subpoenaed for information in a civil lawsuit filed by shareholders who are suing over all this, First Energy shareholders. But yes, there have been no accusations, nothing involving charges or anything like that against those individuals. The only people who are charged, who remain charged right now, are two First Energy, former First Energy executives, Chuck Jones and Michael Dowling, and Larry Householder has been accused of state charges for using some campaign money to defend himself in court. So that's what we have on the table right now.
All right. Let's move to Cleveland, where the city has handed over management of the Westside Market to a nonprofit it formed for that purpose. The Cleveland Public Market Corporation will handle the day-to-day operations of the market and a $44 million renovation. Sam, this has been forever. The idea that the city shouldn't run it. The city's got to clean streets. It's got to empty garbage. It's got a million things to do. And in that department was also, oh, by the way, the West Side Market. So the idea had been born long ago. It was driven by Mayor Bibb because Mayor Frank Jackson had no intention to do it. Now we see the market taking over. It's got its work cut out for it, this nonprofit, though.
Yeah, and the distinction is kind of important. You've mentioned it was under the city. It was in the Department of Public Works, and I think there was a single employee, a manager there, kind of overseeing everything. They announced this week they've hired six employees under an executive director, so a lot more manpower, human power, to handle these operations, including, by the way, a person dedicated to marketing to drive traffic to the market. I think right now the first order of business is this long-deferred maintenance. I think they're doing freight elevators and new stalls. And kind of getting their fundraising picture in order before they tackle the sexier renovations, the master plan renovations, which will begin in 2025, I believe.
The basics are important. We just saw in the last couple of weeks the market closed down because of infrastructure problems.
Well, and one in this master plan, one of the line items is a new emergency generator. So in the past, the market would just close down because it didn't have any power.
Which it did.
Right. Well, they'll, with $2 million is going to a new emergency generator, I think. So that's just one of the many things that will be purchased.
The city is still owner of the market.
That's right. Yep.
Still has funds that are flowing to the market. But what happens because a nonprofit is in charge is there might be other kinds of revenue streams.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's one of the big benefits, at least as it's been described to me, is they have the ability now to go after state and federal tax credits. And the big one is local philanthropy. And it just so happens that the director of the Board of Trustees is Dave Abbott, former head of the Gun Foundation here locally. And he's in his comments, it sounded like it'll be very easy to woo local foundations to give some money to the market. Now, the master plan is like $44 million, and the city has committed $20 million. Listeners might remember that the ARPA designation, the initial ARPA designation was $20 million. Then council cut that back to $10. Then the city found some additional money at the end of last year to give another $10 million. So they've got $20 million from the city, and we'll be raising the rest.
ARPA being the American Rescue Plan Act.
So
COVID money being used for that. You talked about the more sexy things that might happen.
Yeah.
First, you got to
yeah.
fix all the infrastructure.
Sure.
Then they're talking about things that I think people have mentioned forever, which is there are a couple of spots where you can get something to eat and try to eat it at the market, but it isn't really set up. It's not like Reading Market in Philadelphia.
Exactly. That's a great comparison.
But there, where, by the way, DeNix has the best roast pork you've ever had. So if you're in Philadelphia, go to DeNix. But it looks like that's something they're looking to have, a food area, maybe some beer, those
right.
kind of things.
Right, prepared foods. That North Arcade area, that's, I think, envisioned as having two bars and multiple eateries there. They actually plan on installing a commercial kitchen. They're going to redo that mezzanine area for more sitting. One critique you'll hear is that if you get food, you can't put it down anywhere. You know, you got to eat like a trash can or something. So making it more friendly for folks buying prepared foods and stuff.
One of the big questions then that becomes of that is the mix of the traditional market as it has been, as our grandparents and great-grandparents went to, and this kind of yuppified new joint where everyone goes and it's kind of too cool for school.
Well,
so how do you think that's going to be balanced?
Maybe that's a tension in theory, but at least the coverage that I've seen, the vendors are euphoric about this new management structure and the changes that are coming. I mean, they have been complaining for years about negligence and, you know, not enough resources applied to the market. So I think they're overjoyed just to have these new folks here and new money pouring into the market. So I don't know if we'll see that tension, really.
Yeah, I meant not necessarily just for the vendors, but just for nostalgia. The
idea that,
you know, hey, this used to be the market. You just go and you get a rump roast, and it's, you know, and it's kind of like this old feel, and now you're going to a place that's a little too clean.
Yeah.
And I hear that kind of thing. It seems as though the city is saying, we want to keep the nostalgia, but we also want to add the amenities.
Right. I think you'll still very much be able to go get your rump and, you know, garlic or whatever, you know, heads of lettuce. You'll also be able to get a beer, too.
You just described my Friday night meal. All right. Let's move on to the city of Akron. Akron's acting police chief, Brian Harding, the sole finalist for a permanent appointment from Mayor Shamus Malik, has been meeting residents and answering tough questions at town hall forums. He's been grilled about racism in the department where he has served for nearly 30 years. Stephen, residents have many concerns that relates to trust in the department following high-profile shootings. How does Harding address those?
Well, what he's saying is basically that he's going to try to address instances of racism when they pop up in his department, that there'll be consequences. If anything happens, I plan on addressing it. So very little on specifics, more this idea of there'll just be a change in attitude, let's say. And as you mentioned, there's an issue of trust. So he's trying to address that by having this community engagement. Arguing that the more that police and residents know each other as individuals, the better relations will become. But the fact is that's been done before. It's been done many times before. And when asked about why this is different, all he would say really from what I saw is, well, he'd expand the effort to the entire department. It'd be a cultural change. But as far as details, very little at this point.
And that seems to be what distinguishes him. The mayor said he had spoken to two finalists, one of whom he essentially eliminated because that person wasn't as into this public outreach. And where we do have Brian Harding saying, yes, I think it's important, I'll redouble those efforts. In the meanwhile, the mayor's choices, as he sees them, are just down to those who are within the department because of a charter rule that Akron has that says they have to look within the department. There are others, by the way, that interpret it differently and say that he could cast a wide net as they have in the past. The mayor, though, says he wants to pursue a charter amendment so that future searches can go outside the department, but not for this one. Right now, he needs a chief.
Right, exactly. He said this fall he's going to put something out, allow for external hires. So in response to that, Harding was asked, for instance, would he would resign once this passes, if it passes, and then the search would be reopened. And while Harding said he'd be open to the idea, the mayor rejected out of hand, saying he needed someone permanent in place. He's made that clear, and it was his decision as to what would happen.
There was a question that was asked, and it was kind of, the mayor called it kind of a gotcha question, but whether Harding would be willing to resign, like take the job, resign, then the charter amendment passes. Basically, they wouldn't get somebody who would be full-time until there's a charter amendment that is put into place, or that he'd take it and leave so that when the charter amendment is passed, they could search for someone who the community would feel would be better suited and somebody from outside the department. He said, you know, yeah, I guess so. And the mayor stepped in and said, that's a loaded question. It's a non-starter.
Right. He had said, you know, it's gotcha question. He said, it's my decision whether we need a permanent chief now or later. And I've been clear why I think a permanent chief is a critical need to advance, you know, a lot of these reforms I've been talking about. So he has this guy. It seems like he will stick with him despite a sort of change in the law.
All right. We will take a quick break right now. Got so much more to talk about on the roundtable. When we come back, we're going to talk about a number of other issues, including homicide numbers in Cleveland going down. Really good trend, a welcome trend. It's Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Mike McIntyre. We'll be back. You are back with the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Mike McIntyre. I'm joined this week by Sam Allard from Axios Cleveland. That's a newsletter. Sign up for it. Also, Stephen Langell from IdeaStream Public Media. That's a public media organization. Listen to it.
I've
support
heard of
it. Be a member. And Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, who everyone listens to all the time. Karen, good to have you with us, too. All right.
Great to be here.
Before we just wanted to get you back in the conversation. Hey, before we get back to the roundtable, don't let Sam Allard be the only one who knows everything that's going on in Cleveland and across the state. You can prove you've got Allard-like knowledge by taking the IdeaStream News Quiz, which you can find at ideastream.org/quiz. Wait until the end of the show, as I'm sure we'll provide a few more of the answers. And once you ace it, I encourage you to send your results to Sam at sam.allard@axios.com, which I did at 7:30 this morning. Check your email.
I did. I took the quiz.
sam.allard@axios.com. Everyone, Sam, send Sam your results, please.
Why
and I'd love
on
to have
earth?
You join
or,
us.
Or anything else that might come to mind.
It's fun. The quiz is awesome. You get like 8 or 9 questions, I think, and then there's a question about, hey, you want to see the next quiz? Sign up for it. But it really does test your knowledge.
And it was great, and it actually led me to a couple of stories that I wasn't aware of, so it was fun.
Right. That's the cool thing is once you answer it, it'll then give you an option to go take a look at the link. Specifically, if you get it wrong, then you can take a look at that, and it'll tell you what the story is. But we'll tell you most of it right here. Listen to the rest of the show. You're going to get most of the answers right. And that is the next topic. Homicides are down 43% in Cleveland this year compared with this time last year, a much bigger dip than the 20% drop in more than 200 big cities. So we had a bigger dip. Sam, you put together a piece on this. How did Axios compile the numbers for the report?
Well, thank you for asking. Axios has a national data desk, and they sift through dozens of national reports a day. This one came from a national criminal justice analytics firm that puts together national reports, seeks out national trends in crime. And they said, you know, a lot of these cities, there's huge declines in homicides. Take a look in your city. And Cleveland actually, under Mayor Justin Bibb, has been committed to open data. They now actually have a data dashboard. You can search by time period, by type of incident. And sure enough, I verified the homicides are going way down. As of this week, only 29 homicides in Cleveland.
So one is too many. But when you think about the numbers that we've had, which are approaching 100 in a year, the record year being 2020.
Oh, yeah, 192, I
yeah,
think. 190,
hundreds
like that.
In a year. Yeah, exactly. So having that number, what do we attribute that to? What is the reaction from Mayor Bibb?
Well, of course, there are a number of factors, and crime stats tend to ebb and flow. When you ask Bibb, I mean, Bibb never misses an opportunity to tout his commitment to public safety.
Right.
He often generally cites his RISE initiative. Well, listeners, which they might recognize, that's his financial incentives to bring new police officers on the force. And when I asked him this week, they cited the Safe Smart CLE initiative, which was their idea to get private entities to register their security cameras with the city of Cleveland. Those are just some factors that the city has cited.
Now, summer is when it starts to get hot, that's when people start to get killed.
That's
and so
right.
We don't know that this number will hold. We're just saying that at this point, homicides are down.
That's right, although it is reflected nationwide. So there is something going on. You know, it's not. It may not be as fluky as it seems.
We talk about crime. I don't know if it would apply in Cleveland, but crime always is a an election topic, and we've got an election coming up.
Oh, November. Yes. And I think actually, I mean, if you're talking about the presidential election, yeah. I suspect we'll hear a lot about crime just because, I mean, elections tend to prey on the fears and insecurities of the electorate. In this one, we'll probably see crime as it intersects with immigration. I mean, that's the big issue. And I will just mention, I was looking at that dashboard that I mentioned, and last year, if you'll remember the kind of the hysterics about the crime wave in Cleveland, a lot of that was centered on, or the narrative was centered on auto thefts. You'll remember the Kia boys trend.
Right.
And as it happens, so far this year, grand theft motor vehicles are down 30% too. So the car thieves are kind of diminishing just as the homicides are.
I wonder why that is.
Don't know yet. I got a comment from the Cleveland police, but they said, yes, they're down. Didn't give me a reason.
All right, we'll keep digging. The family of a teenager killed during a 2019 Cleveland police pursuit that ended in East Cleveland settled for nearly $5 million in a lawsuit with Cleveland this week. Cleveland police were pursuing a suspected carjacker at high speeds. The suspect struck and killed 13-year-old Tamia Chapman as she was walking from her school to the library. Such a tragedy. And Stephen, the family now is going to get just under $5 million, but they say it wasn't really about the money.
No, and it's such an awful tragedy, such a young life. And what they had said is they just want to prevent this from happening again, from anyone suffering the way that they had suffered and never seeing their child again. But it's absolutely terrible.
The speeds in this chase exceeded safe limits, according to the department's Office of Professional Standards. I think it was like 80, 90 miles an hour, Sam, in these, through city streets.
A little bit less than that, but I think, 75, 80, but in 35-mile-per-hour streets. So, I mean, we're not talking this was not the 2012 police chase, the Timothy Russell, Melissa Williams, the 137 shots.
Right.
But nevertheless, 40 miles per hour over the speed limit in a residential area is just...
It's interesting because I've heard police officers say that they are frustrated by non-pursuit rules. And in fact, just recently in Akron, they've decided they're not going to chase people for equipment violations that they might see, mainly because it can be dangerous to the innocent public. Two, as it did in the Jaylen Walker case, it ended in an exchange of gunfire, and that could all be avoided without a chase. So you see on the police end, someone's committing a crime, we should go catch them. On the other, what collateral could that have on a neighborhood?
Exactly, and that's been an ongoing discussion, certainly in the city of Cleveland. I mean, city council has verbalized the exact same concern that you are, that, we see a criminal doing something, we should go pursue them. It seems crazy not to. But we also see that, like, in these, one reason why these chase policies have been modified across the country is because of all this collateral damage. Pedestrians getting struck and killed.
I think if you put it in the context of pedestrians are walking on the street and you're going to have a high-speed chase, maybe you shouldn't do that in the same way. You wouldn't take out your gun and try to shoot somebody when there's a whole crowd of people
in a mall. Yeah. Right.
In a mall. Yeah. So the idea of innocent folks being in the way would be an issue here. Stephen, the city in the settlement still, though, admits no wrongdoing. So what happened to the officers involved?
Honestly, doesn't seem like very much. Most of them received no discipline whatsoever. In fact, the only two officers that received discipline for this did so, it appears, because they joined in the pursuit without the permission of a supervisor, and that was the main reason why they were disciplined.
So, right, because they joined the pursuit, not
yes.
Those who were initiating it.
Right.
All right, well, we'll continue to follow, obviously, those issues about pursuit, but such a tragedy, as we've mentioned, yeah. And the case has now been settled. The Ohio House has passed a bill that would increase the penalties for human and drug trafficking. House Bill 230 would recategorize the felony classification for trafficking drugs with a focus primarily on fentanyl, which has fueled a spike in overdose deaths throughout the state. Karen, it's a piece of legislation that aims to deter trafficking. Supporters say it'll go after the dealers. We'll get into what the detractors say in just a second. But what are the supporters, the people who are backing this, say that this is necessary for?
Well, this is a recategorization of, like you just said, fentanyl, but also cocaine, heroin, certain kinds of drugs here. And that, of course, means harsher penalties. It also, the bill allows for trafficking less than 1 gram of fentanyl would go from a fifth degree felony to a third degree felony. So again, upping that, specifically targeted at fentanyl. If someone dies of a fentanyl overdose in Ohio, the state would actually mark that on their death certificate. And there's also a new offense of participating in an organization for trafficking in person. persons. So it's really trying to go after both the fentanyl-specific drug trafficking, but also in human trafficking as well.
What's interesting is there is now a knowledge requirement when fentanyl is mixed with certain drugs. There's different schedules, and we don't need to get into all that. But right now, someone who purchases one of those kind of drugs, it could be an antidepressant or some anti-anxiety drug or something of that notion, if it's laced with fentanyl, they could face jail time. And what we hear from the Harm Reduction Ohio group is it makes no legal, moral, or public health sense because you're criminalizing and putting people in jail when they're the victim. They purchased it.
Yeah, and that's been a concern throughout the whole idea of what to do with fentanyl, especially, but in the drug crime area here. How do you make sure that you go after illegal drugs and go after the people who are selling them without punishing people who are purchasing them? Which, you know, it is a crime to purchase illegal drugs, but, you know, if they are seriously injured by fentanyl, I mean, it's a tough situation. And you quite often hear people who are critical of this and other measures saying you can't prosecute your way out of this situation. There have to be other solutions here, and that's kind of in that realm.
The vast majority of overdose deaths in Ohio are related to fentanyl. The Fraternal Order of Police, the Buckeye Sheriff's Association, supported the bill and testified in support of it. But those who oppose it say what we're going to end up with is not actually stopping those overdose deaths. What we're going to do is get a whole lot more low-level people in jails that are already overcrowded with low-level drug offenders.
Yeah, the 13 people who voted against this are all Democrats, including Democratic Representative Juanita Brent from the Cleveland area, who said, you know, this sounds like the war on drugs here, and this is a problem. How many prisons are we going to need to build? She asked on the floor. And there is an answer to that question, according to the people who do the research on legislation for lawmakers. It looks like that prisons would need to add at least 1,300 to 1,500 beds statewide, according to the legislative Service Commission, if this bill does pass the Senate.
And I know that there are those on the prosecutorial side that said they rely on local prosecutors to use this law appropriately and not just go after low-level offenders. We'll see how that plays out.
Yep.
All right. The Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation is now handling a review of an incident April 18th in which an East Canton man died while being arrested in Canton by Canton police. The city released body camera footage that shows an officer kneeling on the back of 53-year-old Frank Tyson after he struggled with officers. Tyson told police he could not breathe. An autopsy is being performed by the Cuyahoga County Medical Examiner's Office. It could take some time. Sam, Tyson apparently fled a traffic accident. I guess his car had hit a pole. He was inside an AmVets hall when police were called because he wouldn't leave. That's where this all begins.
That's right. Yeah. I didn't report this myself, but I did watch the video. There's a scuffle between police and this man, Tyson, within that Veterans Hall. Lasts a couple of minutes. He appears to be in some distress. He's shouting, "Call the sheriff!" And police. It looks like two, maybe more. Kind of subdue him, put handcuffs on him, and as you say, one puts his knee on his back to hold him down. He does say, "I can't breathe," and then he calms down, and it's unclear if he's just. It's unclear what's happening, to be honest, but he passes out, basically.
So it was about 5 minutes later, and police then asked, "Hey, have you calmed down?" And one of the officers says, I think he might be out.
I think he might be out, yeah. And so, they begin to perform CPR, but it's 7 or 8 minutes after he's been unconscious, I think, at that point.
They also administered Narcan, the anti-narcotic drug. So we don't know what the cause of this death was. We don't know if the police arrest procedure had any part in that. What we do know is that the investigation into this is not going to be done by Canton, nor is a medical examiner going to be from Stark County. We'll get a state investigation, a Cuyahoga County medical test. I hear that's going to take weeks.
Oh, yeah. They said 6 to 8 weeks, which is crazy. But, yeah, I guess that's the timeline. And then BCI, Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation, will be leading the investigation.
Okay. That is, and by the way, now a national story. I got a push alert on my phone. So we'll definitely be keeping an eye on that story as well in Canton. Ohio lawmakers are moving ahead with bills intended to get local school districts to limit cell phone use by students in public schools. The Senate passed its version of the bill Wednesday. Governor DeWine called on lawmakers to take up the issue during his State of the State speech earlier this month. The governor said he believes cell phones are a distraction to education and impact students' mental health. A lot of school districts agree. I know in Akron, you've got to put your phone in a yonder pouch. It's the thing you would do when you go to a concert. So you have your phone on you, but you can't access it unless somebody unlocks it for you. So that's one of the options that school districts are doing. In this case, Karen, what the legislature is saying is not we're going to set the rules, but we're going to set a rule that you school districts have to set rules.
Yeah, and existing school districts, it's school districts that have existing policies don't need to update them or anything. This is for school districts that have not set policies. And this, when you look at how long ago it was that DeWine suggested this in the State of the State speech versus how quickly the Senate got to it, this is light speed for the legislature.
Yeah.
So this is really, it sends the message, I think, that there are lawmakers who really believe that cell phone use and social media use as well are a serious concern, a serious problem, a threat to mental health for young people. And so putting this into a bill that actually deals with military certifications for high school graduates really suggests that this is a big deal, because there was a bill that was proposed, but it's going to take a while. So this really says we want to move this forward, hopefully potentially have policies in place for the coming school year starting in August. But the question is now, is it going to move in the House? Because House Speaker Jason Stevens has said he's not real thrilled about the idea, that he thinks that school districts should have the authority to do that. They have the authority to do that, and if they want to, they can go ahead and make policies on their own.
Yeah, but this is basically saying you've got to make a policy, whatever that policy would be. What's interesting, you just mentioned it, and it's a little bit of the sausage making, but they folded it into another bill. The reason you do that is because that bill's already down the grease tracks, and so it's going to be a quick passage.
Exactly. And you see it all the time. And it sometimes results in lawsuits. For instance, the lawsuit over the ban on gender transition treatment for minors and trans athletes in girls' sports, those were two bills that were merged together. So one bill was added to another bill. And the litigation contends that part of the problem here is that there's a single subject rule where it's only supposed to be one subject that a bill is supposed to deal with, and that violated it. I have not yet seen that work as a legal argument. So it's just one of the little complexities of bills here in the legislature.
I think there's one constituency of people who would be opposed to limiting cell phone use at school, and that would be students, right?
I was a
parent. I wanted my kids to put your dang cell phone down and study. I don't want a text from you while you're in class.
Well, but I think they're worried about violence, because those kids can get really angry.
Yeah, and that's a way to amplify that.
But there's another thought of this, too, is that, parents' rights issue. What if parents do want their kids to have at least the phone accessible in case something happens in school? Should parents have the right to make the decision on whether their kids have phones in school? A lot of arguments here that are really interesting to talk about.
Me, I just sent a helicopter with my kids and hovered over them the entire time.
Without Sam? Commenting on the legislation in question, I did see a study this week out of Scandinavia, of all places, that showed dramatic improvement in student performance and in social and mental health when phones were barred. And one of the big things was there was a huge drop in bullying, because students were on social media all the time. Just social relations improved, mental health improved. Again, I don't know what that means for the current legislation, just that there is a correlation.
Nice little light reading in the morning.
Yeah, I saw it on Twitter.
Saunas also help.
That's right.
Let's move on. A state audit concluded that Lakeland Community College in Kirtland is in big financial trouble and is operating at an unsustainable pace. Lakeland serves about 5,000 students in Lake County, and it's just the latest in a long line of colleges and universities facing financial woes as enrollment dips. Sam, the report from Auditor of State Keith Faber, that makes this one a little different. Usually what we're hearing from these schools is they say we're in big trouble and this is happening, like Notre Dame saying we're closing. Here, it's an audit that's saying you guys have a bunch of issues. The way you're going, you're building something new, you're doing all these other things, you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah. Not a real positive report there from Faber. The big issue, I mean, the root cause is, of course, declining enrollment. I mean, you mentioned there's about 5,000 students there, a little less than 5,000. In 2012, as recently as 2012, there was over 9,000 students. So the issue is, as the student body has decreased, the faculty size, the facilities number has stayed roughly the same. So you're in a situation kind of like a shrinking city, like the city of Cleveland, with a declining tax base that still has to fund an enormous amount of infrastructure. You now have a declining student population that's still funding the same number of faculty members, the same number of facilities that are going underused. And Faber noted all of that rather bluntly in his audit.
So what do we think happens? We've seen, as we said, other schools that are cutting. Youngstown State University, Stephen, has just said it's going to be cutting some positions because of its financial woes.
City School District.
Right. Yeah. Well, Cleveland State, University.
So we have colleges, right. We have school districts, we have all kinds of things where that's happening. What do we think? Do we have any idea what the reaction in Lakeland is? Do we see that there's going to be cuts?
Well, Lakeland, funnily enough, the board of directors seemed to be pretty unaware of the financial picture at the school. They said, oh, my gosh, like we had no idea this was happening. And if you're a faculty member there, you might be a little nervous because they've agreed in a statement to follow all of Faber's recommendations, to implement them fully, which include things like cutting medical insurance costs, cutting down salaries or bringing salaries and compensation for summer school in alignment with other peer universities, colleges and universities, and exploring the potential for sale or lease of facilities. So they've got one building in particular that's going completely underused that they might sell or lease, things like that. But also probably cutting faculty positions and staff positions.
That's what's happening in Youngstown. I mean, if I can come out on that. So the Youngstown Board of Education decided April 23rd they were going to cut 20 non-teaching positions, which are administrative and support staff to deal with the deficit. And also they were going to go through vendor contracts and let some of those expire. They're hoping to reduce their budget by $3.5 to $4 million by the end of next year. And that's just, you know, as we mentioned, it's sort of a trend.
Sure.
You see that in Youngstown, Cleveland, Akron school systems are all having these cutbacks.
Well, Bolton-Wallace to even more locally.
So we're going local schools as well as colleges.
Yes. Everybody.
Right. We're mixing it all together.
Yeah. Sorry for the tangent here, but yeah, Bolton-Wallace, they're cutting full academic programs, and I think Cleveland State might explore that too. And I think what we'll find as we approach this, what are they calling it, the enrollment cliff or something like that with fewer and fewer students, colleges are going to have to kind of find their niche. You know, what programs can they really specialize in to attract a student population?
Let's move back to Columbus and talk a little bit about elections. Republican lawmakers are again making a push to close Ohio's primary process. Currently, Ohio law allows voters to choose whatever party's ballot they want for primary elections, either at the polls or when they request an absentee ballot. So you show up and you say, I want to vote in the Republican primary, and you get the Republican ballot or Democratic. Proponents of closing elections at the polls now are saying what they want is to require voters to declare their party affiliation months in advance of primary elections. Karen, is it that people think there's chicanery going on, that you go in and say you're a Democrat when you're really a Republican because you want to influence their primary?
Well, that's been going on for a long time. I mean, I can think back to years in the past when either Bill or Hillary Clinton was on the ballot and there were Republican talk show hosts urging people to go ahead and vote for the Clintons because they thought that they would be a weaker candidate coming up in the fall. So this has been, I don't know that there's really a whole lot of evidence that this kind of thing happens, but the question is then if that's fair game, if that's really being fair in politics, which, you know, you can argue about whether there's anything that's fair in politics right now. But in Ohio, you do not have to register as a Republican or a Democrat. You are affiliated with either of those parties if you do vote in a partisan primary, and that's when you decide it. I mean, you don't have to do it 30 days before or 6 months before or whatever. You decide on the moment when you go to vote. And if you don't vote for either party, you are considered unaffiliated. And so this would require voters and candidates who are switching parties to declare their affiliation 90 days before the election. So that's a long time. And it's interesting to see all the different ways that states handle primaries, and some are completely open, some are completely closed. This would move Ohio from partially open to partially closed.
And the opponents of this say it could disenfranchise voters. So if you show up at the polls and they say, well, you didn't declare whenever, is that what the problem is? Like, how would it be a disenfranchisement?
Well, I think the concern is that people are suggesting that you shouldn't be able to really in your heart be affiliated with one party but pull a ticket for the other party. That's just not fair, that if a lot of people do that, then the person who is selected in the primary is not the true person that the voters really of that party want. And so there are four bills right now that would deal with this in some way or another, but the 90-day vote here with the latest bill is really, I mean, we're seeing that with the whole discussion over President Biden possibly not being listed on the Ohio ballot because of a 90-day deadline. 90 days is a long time to make sure that I'm going to vote for this person 90 days from now, or I'm going to vote for this party 90 days from now.
And speaking of that, in one sentence, it looks like that's going to be resolved, not just for this election year, but it looks like the lawmakers are saying, let's fix this permanently and not make it 90 days.
Well, I don't believe it until it happens.
But they've been talking about it.
They have been talking about it. And the whole idea is that both parties have been hit by this in 2012 and in 2020. And so while the Democrats are only dealing with it right now, it could come back to happen to Republicans and Democrats again.
All right. We got to take a quick break. Before we do that, though, I want to share some reaction from our listeners. This one is from David, who says, my daughter teaches at a local high school, and cell phones are definitely a distraction to learning. The school tried to ban phones in the classroom a couple of years ago. There was more protest from parents than from students.
Really?
So the policy was dropped. The new policy at the school leaves it up to the teacher to determine phone policy for each classroom. Solution was to push the responsibility lower down into overburdened teachers. And he said it shows the issue with the legislation as how will a ban be enforced? Is this going to be left up to the teachers? Good luck with the success of this bill. And that's David's point of view. And David, really appreciate your perspective. Thanks for sharing it. We've got to take a quick break right now, our final one of the program. We come back, lightning round, got a lot more to talk about. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Mike McIntyre. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Mike McIntyre with Karen Kassler, Sam Allard, and Stephen Langell. Got a lot of reaction from our listeners as we've been having our conversations on the issue of Lakeland Community College. Susan says, as a longtime alum of Lakeland Community College, I hope that Lakeland can solve their financial woes. It may be the only way some can afford college. It certainly was for me. JP says, I don't for one minute believe Mike DeWine didn't know about that dark money. He's not stupid. I do believe he didn't lose any time signing HB 6, and that's JP's point of view. And then we've got one final thought. Do we? I thought we did. Oh, yeah, Michael. Michael Quinn, our regular, usually he tells us a joke, but this time he's given us some actual good information. And that is, there's one great place to eat at the market. At the West Side Market, the balcony at the West End, and it's a great view of the activity at the same time. I totally agree. Not a comfortable place to sit, but it's a cool place to people watch and to eat a falafel. All right, moving on. Frontier Airlines says it's ending its direct route flight from Cleveland Hopkins International Airport to Montego Bay, Jamaica. Turnabout comes a month after the direct route launched. On the bright side, now you don't have to wait in line for 3 hours to check your bags at Frontier for your trip to Jamaica. Sam, you reported on this for Axios. What happened? How did it get canceled so quickly?
Well, very quickly. I think it just there wasn't sufficient demand. I mean, they have a statement about the U.S. travel advisory to Jamaica that may be convincing some American travelers not to go down there. But the truth is there just wasn't enough people taking the route. I think Frontier, though, as they establish their new crew base, they're going to be experimenting with some different routes to see what's popular. They've got 10 or 11 new routes launching next month. So we're going to see how those do soon.
Yeah, sorry about that joke. It's just that I did have a long wait in a line just to go to Florida. And it happens. And I really appreciate the people that were overburdened in a lot of work. But it was through the airport
line.
It's
okay, Mike. You're allowed to make that joke, okay. but you should just bring a carry-on next time. I don't know why you're checking
you
bags.
You know what it is? It was all carry-on. It was a golf clubs.
And, well.
I know.
You put those in the overhead.
First world problems is what you're trying to say?
I
got it.
Shove those in up here.
But they're little clubs. I'm not a real big guy.
You just throw them in.
The nonprofit Keep Akron Beautiful is launching a new initiative to reverse the city's declining tree canopy. It's currently at 34%. It's in danger of falling to just 30 by 2040. The group is kicking off its Planting Change campaign tomorrow at Hardesty Park with the aim to plant 100,000 trees by 2043. Today is National Arbor Day. Ohio celebrates Arbor Day tomorrow. A bunch of other Northeast Ohio cities are having tree canopy problems, Cleveland, Canton, Youngstown, all of those. Stephen, Jenny Hamill discussed with experts yesterday on the Sound of Ideas the declining tree canopy and how it has major health implications, especially on our air quality.
Well, that's true. I mean, for instance, the American Lung Association had a report released this week that showed that the Cleveland metropolitan area ranked as 31st worst, so one of the worst in the country when it comes to ozone pollution. And that's based on the number of unhealthy air quality days per year. Also, Samira Malone, the director of the Cleveland Tree Coalition, said that, trees reduce asthma, cardiovascular disease, and also can have improvement on mental health, cool down communities, drive down utility costs. There's a variety of benefits.
Yeah, it makes them cooler. It makes them prettier.
Yes.
I mean, neighborhoods with trees are better neighborhoods. And we see a lot of these neighborhoods, particularly in urban areas, that just don't have enough tree cover. So one of the ways to solve that is to plant a tree.
Right.
And in Akron, that event tomorrow is going to give residents a chance to do that.
Right. The first 100 residents will be able to get a tree, and it's sort of a festival atmosphere with a lot else going on to bring people on in. But you're absolutely right. I mean, what I'd seen is that when you look at redlining of neighborhoods, that's where the tree canopy drops, is when you get into neighborhoods that were historically minority neighborhoods.
Got it. Let's talk about Cedar Point. This year, the amusement park is bringing back its signature Top Thrill Dragster coaster with a new name, Top Thrill 2.
Top Thrill 2?
Yeah, I hope they didn't pay a consultant for that one. what should it be? How about Top Thrill 2?
If you want to get conspiratorial, I've got a little idea about that. But
you can't have loose items in your pocket on the ride now. You'll have to pay for a locker before you get in line, meaning there could be long waits with no Candy Crush to pass the time on your phone. So that's something people are complaining about, that there isn't a lot of these coasters have a locker just before you get on.
Sure.
You get it as soon as you get off. It's been closed since August 2021 after a metal object flew off the ride and struck a Michigan woman in the head. Top Thrill 2 is just as tall and fast, but a much longer ride. And we saw all these folks from the media. I saw this great video from Josh Gunther from Cleveland.com, who, by the way, might be the biggest coaster enthusiast outside of Karen Kassler and the entire planet. So it looked like a lot of fun. People were having fun, except the Sandusky Register didn't have anyone there, and I wonder why, Sam.
Yes, well, Cedar Point didn't deign to tell us why they didn't let them, but we can hazard an educated guess, or certainly the Register has hazarded a guess. This is probably to do with critical coverage recently, not only about the Top Thrill incident of 2021 and the aftermath, but also about the potential merger between Cedar Fair and Six Flags, which could have some serious financial ramifications for the Ohio shareholders. The Register has been pretty aggressive in reporting that out, including quoting Ohio shareholders, negatively characterizing the Cedar Fair ownership directors. And they weren't too happy about that. So that's why they're thinking they probably weren't invited.
They also have been doing some reporting about private police force that Cedar Point had.
Which was disbanded in 2022. But actually some local TV stations did some great reporting on kind of cover-ups back in the 80s and 90s at the Cedar Point dorms.
What was interesting about the response to that, according to the Register, when they posted this thing, the community response on their post was not, hey, you know, let them in. They're protecting us. They're writing these types of things. They're saying, hey, Cedar Point's a big player. Quit being so negative.
Yeah, they said, go Cedar Point, like, good for them. The Register doesn't deserve to be here after their lopsided coverage. It was wild to see. But we have to remember, Cedar Point is not only a, you know, world-renowned amusement park, it's also the city of Sandusky's largest business and tax revenue generator. So people are fiercely loyal to the park.
Sure.
And we also know that community pillars, institutions, they love it when you cheerlead them, but the moment you start applying some scrutiny, they don't get too happy.
It reminds me of Browns fans.
Yes.
Karen, you're a big, aside from all that, you're a big roller coaster enthusiast. Are you going to get on the Top Thrill 2 sometime soon?
Well, I am concerned about the Register not being allowed in there, but I want to go. And if I don't go, my son, who I have raised correctly in this regard, will be providing me a review when he goes for his trip later on this month.
All right. Love it.
Next month.
Run away.
Yes.
That's what I would do.
Let's talk one last story here. Does Cleveland's flag, the city flag, need a makeover? Did you know Cleveland had a city flag? A lot of people don't even know that.
Oh, I absolutely did. Mike,
let's put it this way. I bet you have no idea the Cleveland flag looks like. Many people have no idea. I knew you do, Sam, but it's not what you would call memorable. And there's a community push to solicit new designs with the hope of convincing the city to hoist a new flag. The Cle Flag Project, sponsored by the Cleveland chapter of the American Institute of Graphic Arts, presented the idea to a city council caucus meeting. And basically, Mike Polensic told him to get off his lawn.
Yeah, well, Polensic, of course, said they've got other things to worry about. I actually should say, in the interest of disclosure, one of the people on that Cle Flag group is an Axios employee, not an editorial. He's like an HR person, but he lives in Cleveland, and he's involved in this flag effort.
This has been going on for a while. Our Gabe Kramer, maybe 4 years ago or so, did a video about people pushing for a change in the flag. And you look at some other flags. The one in Chicago is iconic. A lot of flags really tell you something about that community. Stephen, why do proponents want to change this city's flag?
Well, they're very subtle about it. They call it unattractive and outdated and
very
unrecognizable to the city and just generally displeasing to the eye. The original pattern was created in 1896, and they want to update it a bit. And just it was actually created in 1895 by an art student after the Plain Dealer ran a contest.
Yeah. Sounds like the whole Chief Wahoo thing was the same deal.
And she won 50 silver dollars. And the person that gave her the award, she later married.
Oh, right. The reporter from the Plain Dealer.
The reporter from the Plain Dealer.
What's interesting about that flag is it has a small logo with small writing. Those are, by the way, verboten on flags. You're not supposed to have those kind of things. You can't see what they are. If you take it off, it looks like the French flag. And so there are a lot of those kind of criticisms. It'd be interesting to see if something does come of this as Mike Polensic gets behind it.
Well, council, of course, is also concerned that a flag might be designed by someone not from the city of Cleveland. However, the original flag was the woman, I believe, was from Ashtabula or something. So.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it. All right, we're going to wrap it there. I want to say thanks so much to you, Sam Allard, for coming over. Appreciate you being on the show.
Always a pleasure.
Stephen Langell, really good to have you here as well.
You bet.
And Karen, great to have you join the conversation, as always.
It's always great to be with you.
All right. And as we close the program, an appropriate song for National Arbor Day, Sugar Magnolia is a beautiful tree and a beautiful song by the Grateful Dead.
Sugar magnolia, blossoms blooming, heads all empty and I don't care. So my baby down by the river, knew she'd have to come up soon.
To get the last word on today's topics, send an email to SOI at ideastream.org or on Twitter, now X, at Sound of Ideas. Monday on the Sound of Ideas, we will dig into the decline in Cleveland homicides with insights from our criminal justice reporter, Matt Richmond. Jenny Hamill will be back in the chair for that. If you missed any part of this program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast, which you can get on any podcast app. You can also hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. And check out the television version tonight at 7:30 on WVIZ PBS. That show is called Ideas. I'm Mike McIntyre. Thank you so much for listening, and stay safe.
She comes skimming through rays of violet. She can wait in a drop of dew. She don't come and I don't follow. Waits backstage while I sing to you. But she can dance a Cajun rhythm. Jump like a widow's in four-wheel drive. She's a summer love in the spring, fall, and winter. She can